When I visited Paris during my sabbatical, a friend told me that I absolutely had to see the Lee Miller exhibit. Now, I didn't know who Lee Miller was, but between visits to the classic Parisian museums filled with all those famous paintings and sculptures, I decided to take my friend's advice and learn about this iconic woman from the early 20th century. After waiting in line for more than an hour, when I finally got inside, I quickly realized what all the fuss was about. For those of you who, like me, maybe weren't familiar with Lee Miller, hers is a remarkable and difficult story. And I want to warn you that I'll be talking about some triggering topics like sexual abuse and the Holocaust. So if you notice yourself affected, I invite you, please take care of yourself. Do what you need to do. And this talk is dedicated to anyone who's been dehumanized, diminished, deceived, or abused. Lee Miller was born in Poughkeepsie, New York, in 1907. When she was 7 years old, she was sexually abused by a family acquaintance. Her father was an enthusiastic amateur photographer who taught her about photography, but who also photographed Lee nude throughout her childhood and adolescence. Her childhood was complicated and troubling, and no doubt contributed to the many choices that she made in her life. As a young woman, Lee became one of the most sought-after fashion models of the 1920s. She appeared in Vogue, and the most famous photographers of the time wanted to photograph her. She was beautiful, magnetic, and modern, with a boyish look. But after a while, Lee grew tired of being the object everyone else was looking at and yearned to find and express her own voice. So in her early 20s, against her father's wishes, she moved to Paris to join its thriving artistic community, and she became friends with Picasso, Jean Cocteau, Paul Éluard, and other members of the Surrealist movement. And she sought out the famous photographer Man Ray and soon became his student, collaborator, and then partner and muse. But even the word muse can diminish a woman, can't it? It suggests that her purpose was to inspire the real artist. It places her before the camera while someone else determines how she will be seen. And Lee Miller wasn't content to remain an image in someone else's story. She developed a powerful eye of her own. She understood light and shadow and composition and emotional truth. So she stepped behind the camera. And that transition feels spiritually and emotionally significant. In a man's world, she moved from being looked at to looking, from being framed and controlled by others to deciding what belonged within the frame, and from being interpreted to becoming an interpreter of the world. Now, many women, including myself, have gone through that transition from objectification and powerlessness to finding their strength and authority as they grow older. Anyone else here? So Lee established her own photography studio and quickly became successful. And after moving to London with her new partner and soon-to-be husband, Roland Penrose, she began photographing for British Vogue. And then the Second World War broke out, and the focus of her photography changed. Tired of the banality of fashion photography, she started to document the Blitz and the lives of women contributing to the war effort. But she wanted to get even closer and observe the real truth of what was happening in mainland Europe. So she became an accredited American war correspondent and traveled to France shortly after D-Day. Now, women correspondents were supposed to remain in safe areas far from combat. Yet like Joan of Arc, Lee donned men's clothes and insisted she go to Saint-Malo in France, where battle was still raging. There she documented the horrors of what she saw, dodging bombs and bullets in the process. She then went on to photograph the liberation of Paris, more of the fighting across Europe, and eventually the liberation of Buchenwald and Dachau concentration camps. She was no longer photographing beautiful clothing and staged models arranged in perfect light. Now she was photographing destroyed cities, wounded soldiers, starving prisoners, Nazi suicides, and trains upon trains filled with bodies. As I made my way through the exhibit in Paris, I became increasingly shaken by what I saw. She captured the horrors of war by looking directly at what human beings had done to other human beings and then asked the viewer to look with her. We weren't allowed to use cameras in the concentration camp section in reverence to all those who had lost their lives. But the photos were shocking. With the images she sent back to Vogue, she included the words, "I implore you to believe this is true." She realized how easy it was to deny the existence of these horrors by virtue of distance from the center of atrocities. Even her friends and family seemed removed from what was actually going on. So she implored the world to believe what was happening, to not look away, to become aware of the horrors happening throughout Europe. And her photos brought back my own visits to Dachau and Buchenwald during my previous sabbatical, which had shaken me to the core. Even decades later, standing in those places was deeply disturbing. You walk through the gate aware that thousands of people walked through that same gate and never got to walk out again. There's a sense that the ground itself still holds the pain of its history. And I remember the barracks and the crematorium and the tiny room in which people were detained, and the sense of incomprehension at the scale and horror of what happened there. And I was visiting them 80 years after the fact. I was safe. I could leave whenever I wanted. And yet it stirred up all the current ways in which humans dehumanize one another and the unthinkable cruelty and horrors that we can inflict on each other and do every day in our world still today. Now, I can't compare my experience with Lee Miller's. I can barely imagine what it must have been like to arrive immediately after liberation, when the bodies were still there and the stench of death infused the air, and when the traumatized survivors stood before her and the physical evidence of human cruelty was all around. How did she even lift her camera? How did she bear witness without allowing the horror to overcome her? And what compelled her to keep looking? Lee arrived at Dachau on April 30th, 1945. And later that day, she traveled with her colleague, David Sherman, to Munich, where they entered Hitler's recently evacuated apartment. And it happened to be the same day that Hitler died in Berlin. Although I don't think she knew that at the time. And there, David Sherman took one of the most iconic photographs of Lee Miller. She is sitting in Hitler's bathtub. A portrait of Hitler is visible beside her, and her uniform is folded nearby. and on the clean white bath mat sit the heavy boots she'd worn at Dachau, still covered with the dirt of the camp. She had carried Dachau into Hitler's pristine home. She had brought the reality he created across his own threshold. And I think there's something really bold and defiant in that image. She's washing the filth of war from her body in the private sanctuary of the person responsible for all that suffering. And I was speechless by her courage and defiance. And perhaps this is what courageous visionaries do. They carry the truths that society wants to keep hidden into the rooms where decisions are made, into the halls of government, into the classroom, into the family conversation, onto the streets, and into the pulpit. They bring what has been hidden across the threshold and say, believe, this is true. We need to look at this. And our own Shannon is doing that every week here when she shares which immigrants have been kidnapped by ICE. And others of you do that regularly too, around the realities of climate change, war, human rights, immigration, and racial justice. You call on us to see what can easily be hidden or ignored in the noise. But Lee's courage came at a terrible personal cost. After the war, she suffered from depression, alcoholism, and what we now recognize as post-traumatic stress disorder. And much of her work remained hidden until her son, Anthony, discovered it after her death. He didn't know what she had experienced during the war, during her life. And he's seen here as a young boy with Lee's friend Pablo Picasso. After visiting the exhibit, I watched the recent film Lee, starring Kate Winslet, and I urge you to see it. I think it's available on Amazon Prime. And I also saw other documentaries and read more about Miller's life, but even after learning so much, I found that she kept haunting my thoughts. Some people, I think, just enter our awareness and remain there. Their stories tug at us. They disturb something. They awaken something. And they ask something of us before we even know what it's all about. And Malala Yousafzai is another such a courageous woman. Earlier today, we heard how Malala grew up loving school in Pakistan. She was only 11 when she began writing anonymously about life under Taliban rule and about the importance of education for girls, something so fundamental. And then at the tender age of 15, she was shot on her way to school for speaking out. But the call Malala heard was not to become a martyr. It was a call to learn, to speak, to insist that girls are fully human and are worthy of equal opportunity. Miraculously, she survived her assassination attempt and she continued her advocacy and she eventually became the youngest person ever to receive the Nobel Peace Prize. And sometimes the world turns an ordinary human longing into an act of extraordinary courage. A girl who goes to school and longs to learn. A woman who wants to stand behind the camera and show the world what she sees. Why should either of these things require so much courage? We love stories about heroines. But too often we valorize their courage without asking why the world demanded so much courage from them. So I want to be clear here. Our work is not only to raise courageous girls. Our work is to create a world in which girls don't have to risk their lives or their bodies to be educated, to be heard, to be believed, to be safe or free. Yes? Let me say that again. Our work is to create a world in which girls don't have to risk their lives or their bodies to be educated, heard, believed, safe, or free. Amen. And something about the courage of Lee and Malala reminded me of another woman that I had admired. Inspired by her strength and mysticism, I'd long wanted to walk in the footsteps of Joan of Arc, who lived in the early 1400s. So I visited Orléans on my sabbatical, where Joan's story is woven through the streets, churches, and identity of the city. Now, it's one thing to read that a teenage peasant girl helped change the course of French history. But it's another thing to stand in the city whose liberation is forever connected with her name. Before the armor, the banners, the victories, the trial, and the fire, Joan was simply a young peasant girl in the village of Domremy. She was about 13 when she began hearing what she described as voices from God. The voices told her that she had a part to play in freeing France from English occupation and bringing Charles to Reims to be crowned king. Now, of course, I wonder about these voices. Were they really divine revelation? Or were they some kind of mystical experience or intuition? Or the fierce imagination of a young woman living amid violence and political chaos? Perhaps they were some combination of all of these things. Now, of course, we don't know what Joan experienced, but we do know that she heard something and took it very seriously. So at about age 17, she left home and went to a local military commander to ask for help in reaching Charles. Of course, she was dismissed, but she went back, and then she was dismissed again. And yet she came back again. And again. And eventually, wearing soldiers' clothing, her hair cut, and accompanied by an escort, she traveled through dangerous territory to meet Charles. And she convinced him to allow her to accompany French forces to Orléans to save the town from the English. And against every expectation, the siege of Orléans was lifted because of her vision. And Joan then helped escort Charles to Reims for his coronation. And for a brief and astonishing time, this teenage girl with no formal education, wealth, or military status became a source of courage for the entire nation. And she didn't do this because she believed herself powerful. She began because she believed herself called. Sometimes a calling carries us to a place we can't imagine. Yet sadly, Joan's calling and success didn't protect her either. She was eventually captured, handed over to the English, accused of heresy, and tried by a church court aligned with English interests. Her voices and authority were questioned, and even her clothing choices were used against her. The institution that should have helped her discern her religious experience instead tried to control, reinterpret, and condemn it. Her judges asked whether she knew herself to be in God's grace. And of course, it was a trap. If she said yes, they could accuse her of spiritual arrogance. And if she said no, she would condemn herself. So Joan answered, "If I am not, may God put me there. And if I am, may God keep me there." What extraordinary clarity from someone still in her teens. And then Joan was burned at the stake at about the age of 19. Standing in Orléans, I found myself wondering about the girl beneath all the mythology. Was she afraid? Did she doubt herself? Did she ever wish that those voices would choose someone else? We tell stories about courageous people as if they possess something that the rest of us don't, as if they were born without fear, as if they see the whole path before taking the first step. But perhaps they were actually like you and me, afraid and moved anyway. Perhaps they doubted and listened anyway. Perhaps they saw only the next step ahead. But I want to be careful here because I don't want to valorize those women and insist we all need to be like them. They all underwent terrible hardships amidst their call. But what I do want to suggest is that we listen to what is calling us most deeply and maybe find some consciousness about why it is calling us to. And to remind us that we don't have to suffer to do something really courageous. And of course, Joan's story is inseparable from warfare, from nationalism and religious certainty. So we have to be careful because every inner voice is not the voice of God. Intensity of conviction doesn't make a person right. Right? History contains too many people who committed terrible acts while claiming divine authority. So an inner call requires discernment. And that's where I believe that our Unitarian Universalist tradition can guide us. We honor direct experience of transcending mystery and wonder. And we affirm that revelation is not sealed, that sacred truth didn't stop speaking thousands of years ago. But we also bring reason, conscience, community and humility to what we hear, and we test the inner call by the love it evokes, right? Does this voice lead towards compassion? Does this calling honor the dignity of others? Does it enlarge life and freedom? Does it reflect our values? Is it loving? A voice that feeds our superiority or dehumanizes another person is not the voice of love. Beneath the noise and fear, I believe there's a deeper knowing within us, and it doesn't always shout. Sometimes it whispers, pay attention, or tell the truth, or it may say, ask for help. Or perhaps this part is yours to tell. And as I reflected on this topic, I was surprised to realize the irony of preaching this sermon about being called to be a courageous visionary woman on the 11th anniversary of my ordination, answering my call to the Unitarian Universalist ministry. I'd not planned that. And not to say that I'm in any way as courageous as these women I've spoken about, but I notice my own call to speak the truth about things that matter, about things that many in society don't want to look at or speak about, and to make meaning and find hope in the midst of difficult times. And yes, it takes courage and deep discernment each week to listen to what inside me really wants and needs to be spoken. So as Chalice people whose mission encourages all of us to be spiritually courageous, I invite you into a moment of inner listening. Take a deep breath. You don't need to find an answer right now. Simply notice what arises. What quiet knowing has been gnawing at you? What truth has been asking for your attention? Something in me called me to make a connection between these women and share their important stories with you. So a calling may simply be the place where that what we perceive meets with what love requires of us. Sometimes courage is making a difficult phone call, setting a boundary or telling the truth gently. Sometimes it's protecting someone vulnerable or challenging an unkind remark, or making our way through an illness that feels scary, or standing on the street with signs. And sometimes it's creating something beautiful, or making art, or singing a song, or refusing to abandon ourselves and others. The call rarely gives us the whole map. More often it gives us the first step and perhaps the next, if we're lucky. Joan heard what others couldn't hear and acted on it. Lee saw what others refused to see and documented it. And Malala said what others were afraid to say and spoke publicly about it. So listen, discern, look within and without, and speak. Not because we're fearless or because we possess extraordinary strength or courage, not because we know how everything's going to turn out, but because love asks something of us. So let's take another breath. Think of one place in your life where something is asking for your attention. Don't ask yourself to solve everything or even something huge. Simply ask, what is love asking of me now? What is love asking of me now? And then ask, what is one small step I can take toward it? The world doesn't need each of us to become Joan of Arc, Lee Miller, or Malala Yousafzai. The world needs each of us to become more fully ourselves, more willing to listen, more willing to see, more willing to speak, and more willing to shape what we do next. My friends, maybe we've come quiet enough to hear the voice that calls us. May we become spiritually courageous enough to see what is needed. May we become faithful enough to answer that call and take the next step. And may we always remember that we do not have to do it alone. May it be so.